Hello, everyone. Welcome to
Cinematic Underdogs. I'm your host, Jordan Puga.
And I'm your other host, Paul Keelan. And we're here and we're back with Matt B. And Matt, what's up?
Hey, what's up, guys? Great to be back.
Thank you for coming back, Matt. I'm stoked for today's movie. Just to let everyone know, we are going through Sudden Death, like a 90s classic in my opinion, but I don't want to hype this up too much here. And Matt's going to go in and help us with this discussion for sure.
Yeah, he's definitely not only going to help us. Matt is a Pittsburgh native, so he's going to, I think, lay the groundwork for this whole movie. I'm really
he's
going
to bring
stoked.
Credibility to our discussion.
Exactly. And let's just start off a little bit. This is a teaser for the episode before we do some of the groundwork, before we pregame. I just want to get a little bit of your history right off the bat for our listeners with this movie and with the fact that you grew up in Pittsburgh. Where in Pittsburgh did you grow up, and what is your first memory of seeing this film like?
Yeah, it's funny you ask about the first memory. I feel like a lot of stuff around that came out in theaters around this time. You remember seeing like in theaters, and it was mostly terrible movies, one of which I think we'll talk about, that came out the same weekend of Sudden Death, and that's Tom and Huck. But my first Sudden Death experience was just on TV. It became one of those cable rewatches for a lot of people and for our generation. And I grew up in the East End of Pittsburgh. And not only is it like set there and the Penguins are playing in game 7, but they use like the announcers from the Penguins. They use the play-by-play guys, who was known for having all these ridiculous catchphrases that are funny. But this movie was always on TV. For some reason, it became almost more enjoyable to watch than like a Die Hard or other Die Hard ripoffs that were emerging and that came out around this time. Something ridiculous about this film. And Pittsburgh was having a moment in the mid-90s, just a few years before that Striking Distance came out with Bruce Willis. That was not a good movie at all, but it looked really good. Rowdy Harrington was a director, and he was from like West Virginia and Pittsburgh as well. And Peter Himes, he's almost overqualified to direct this movie. And Tarantino described Peter Himes like that when they talked about The Relic on their Video Archives podcast a couple months ago. And I felt that here too. So my connection, this movie, if you grew up or lived in Pittsburgh at any point in your life, this film was a huge part of it, because it was a good movie and it was about hockey, which meant, I think, more than any other sport to people who are from there.
Yeah.
Even for us, carrying on, because like me and Paul, obviously we discussed, we grew up together watching movies together. And this is one of those ones that was almost like a rite of passage film, because we're such giant hockey fans, huge Van Damme fans, and it was rated R. So it's like one of those ones. Do you remember like my dad taking us to see this one? Paul kind of took all the boys on the block after we were playing hockey, I think. Kind of just said, "You guys want to go see this Van Damme movie?" And we're all like super stoked. You know, dad's taking us to see the R-rated movie, and it just like delivered. It gave me a different look to hockey that I hadn't seen from like Mighty Ducks or even Slapshot. Because that's one of the old man movies that's always on the background. Like I said, those TV movies is always on. I always had this on a pedestal of like that high quality action movie. So I'm stoked to get into like kind of what you're saying, like whether it holds up and like the nostalgic quality to me for this movie. Cause like this had like, we just mentioned, like this was the height of the Penguins like mania. We're way over here in LA. We're Kings fans. And we're also like sidebar Penguins fans. Love Lemieux, Yager, Luke Robitaille in this one, right? So it had like this whole, like you just mentioned, like element of hockey that just like spoke to our region, like way across on the other side of the US. I find fascinating, like kind of connects to you, is this weird pride to be a hockey fan and have like a Van Damme movie, right? And it's like, it sounds stupid to say, but I was so stoked, like Van Damme's going to be in a hockey movie. So that's always what I remember about this. I always like throw this on with such high expectations.
I love that you brought up too, that your dad took us, and it was like perhaps my first rated R movie in a theater. And I remember part of the joy of this movie was like this secret I had, because I like never told my parents we went to see it. I think we told them I saw probably Tom and Huck instead. You know what I mean? And so like I always had this like giddy, thrilling secret that I saw this like kick-ass action, die-hard type movie that my parents, who were pretty strict, wouldn't let me see at that age. And I loved it even more for that. And so on that topic, to kick things off, I think it'd be fun to each pick a movie that we would choose if we had retroactively one choice to go to the theaters and buy a ticket. I would say my one rule is it can't be Sudden Death, because that's our episode of the night. So like, I want to spread the love a little bit. Just like, you have only $5 for allowance from your parents, and it's $5 at the local Cineplex. Like, so
my heart hurt movies, man. It used to be $5. You just get a $5 bill and go see a movie. And I think have some change to get the popcorn thing that I used to take Paul's candy from, if I remember right.
poor Jordan, he lives in California where everything's like $100. Out here in Phoenix, we're still in the like 90s. It's like $6.25 for a primetime Friday night theater. So like, you just got to move out here, my friend.
You're on to something.
But anyways, I'm going to go over all the movies that were opening on December 22nd, right at the end of 1995. So it's Christmas weekend. You know, what a great Christmas movie. Die Hard's the Christmas classic. I love that they threw Sudden Death out. I don't even know if they were that canny or like clever, because I don't think Die Hard became a Christmas movie until like the aughts, or at least like maybe 10 to 15 years
in the internet.
Yeah. I know that it was one right away, but I don't think that like it became this zeitgeist thing until much more recently. So I'm just going to run through the list. We got Waiting to Exhale. Jordan, I know you watched that a bunch with your sister. Matt, you could chime in here as well. Like, what do you guys remember about this movie first, Waiting to Exhale?
It had Taye Diggs, right?
I think it had Whitney Houston and Taye Diggs and Angela Bassett. Yeah.
I remember it had Taye Diggs and all the ladies go wild for that movie. But it actually had a really good story, though. I mean, it was a good coming of age. So I don't remember it very well. It was like the background movie for like the women in my household. Like Van Damme Predator is my dad's background movie. So it was like that other one, you know, kind of play my toys. I catch up. It was a great love story, though. I remember it had all the feels. Like, it's one I wouldn't put my ticket on this one, but it's one I'd have to go maybe stream.
Nice. Yeah, I only saw this movie during COVID or during the pandemic first time, because there's an iconic shot that people would share a lot on Twitter or elsewhere of Angela Bassett walking away from a blowing up car, her car just like lighting up fire. She's like walking like a badass. And this film had all the heavy hitters from that time, right? Dennis Haysbert, McKelty, Williamson, who was in Heat, who was in Forrest Gump. Wesley Snipes had like a small role, Giancarlo Esposito. Yeah, it was rare to see, or even to this day, a movie about like middle-aged divorcees and who are Black, even for like white people, that they were not making films like this. And to see like this complexity of a film back then, it was kind of nice. Like, it was just women going through struggles of their relationships. This film rocked. When I saw it during COVID, I was like, wow, the music is really good. There's a great scene towards the end of the movie where they're all in the car, all the four best friend girls. And I think TLC's in it in one scene for like a second. And I was like, damn, this is kind of having fun with the idea. It's not too dark, but this would be my pick. Either this or Nixon. I've never seen Nixon, but I love Oliver Stone. And this is wild that this came out, that Nixon is like a Christmas release movie. I think Balto checks out, but the fact that movie's coming out.
I didn't even see Balto on there.
Yeah,
I don't know anything about Balto. Can you guys fill me in about that one? Maybe I'm just not catching the name.
Remember, right? That's the one with like the dog who's got to get the medicine, and he's like, it's like sleighs and it's animated and it's all like late 19th century stuff, right? Am I summarizing this correctly?
I remember seeing it a few times. I think Kevin Bacon or someone played the voice of the dog. This is a big hit. First of all, I was going to say that Sudden Death was kind of like the Die Hard for my our generation, you know, the movie we felt more in simpatico with. But yeah, Balto, it's like about a husky on the go, and Bridget Fonda, Phil Collins, it's got all these like heavy hitters.
Yeah.
And I think it was Amblin released it, but it felt like a movie kind of like Anastasia or like Fern Gully. It wasn't Disney, but it was like these other like kind of creepier films that were also really good quality.
Pretty high stakes. It's pretty much like race through the tundras and stuff. Pretty fun movie. Like, worth a watch, actually. If you're ever getting on like animation kick and you come across Balto, definitely throw that on.
People like this movie a lot. But yeah, what a weekend.
Right. What a weekend is right. Yeah. I mean, Anthony Hopkins plays Nixon, and I've never seen that either. That's a weird blind spot on my Oliver Stone list. And we love to talk Oliver Stone, because our top five, maybe my top five, I don't know where it fits on Jordan's top five sports movie list, is Any Given Sunday. So
it's definitely in the top five. I'm with you. It fluctuates, but
yeah.
So
would that be yours, Paul Nixon?
You know what? I'm going to try to wait till the end a little bit more, you know, get some conversation going to rehash my memories and stimulate my mind. But that might be my top two. But what's weird too is Nixon, I was thinking, oh, that must have been a huge hit. You know, like, that was definitely in that era where we loved these films that were biopics, were about political figures more. But I saw that it only grossed $13 million off of a $44 million budget. So, I mean, it was a bomb. Did not have a successful theatrical run at all, which I just find kind of intriguing. But that probably means it's pretty damn good, to be honest. if I had to give my two cents there, definitely the biggest box office hit, or one of the few biggest on this whole list, is Grumpier Old Men. Yeah. And maybe I'm just revealing a little bit too much about my family and our sensibilities, but man, we love the Grumpier Old Men movies. Jack Lemmon, Walter Matthau, and just the silliness of the plot, right? Of course, they're cantankerous old men, but just like they're trying to save their bait shop from turning into an Italian restaurant. And then there's like this, you know, geriatric romance going on. And I remember being a kid and finding it hilarious, which is interesting. I just remember really finding these movies charming and funny. And I'm almost terrified to even say that out loud because I do not know how they age. I haven't seen them since 1995, but I remember loving them as a kid. And when I like see the poster and think about them distantly, like I don't remember much of like individual scenes or like the details, I think it would be pretty bad humor. But maybe not, maybe not. I mean, I love Bad News Bears. I love Walter Matthau. So does anyone else have memories with this one or like have a more like...
More in passing is more that it was... Who's Dennis is the Menace's next door neighbor? It's his actual name that Matthau played. I can't think of his name. Is it George?
I think it's George. Yeah.
I think it's George. I could be wrong. I have to Google check me, folks. But the fact that he was like the next door neighbor from Dennis the Menace, like the 90s version with Christopher Lloyd and whatnot, made me want to watch this movie like when it would show up again. So this one's like for me is like maybe on the list of my ticket. But yeah, it's one I remember. Like kind of like you said, my parents used to love this one too. And it was really funny. Like I remember that, like you said, as a kid, actually like coming in and kind of laughing. But it's one I don't think I've seen. Like from beginning to end though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this was the first time. So I just moved to Pittsburgh in 94 from Omaha, Nebraska. And I remember, I think our TV, we had like TMC. I remember catching Species, which came on 95 on TV one day. I was like, holy shit, this scared, that scarred me for a while. I mean, it was one of those, you know, you shouldn't have been looking at. And like when you go to Blockbuster, you go to the video cassette because she's like basically half naked in the on the back cover of it, Natasha Henstridge. But yeah, Grumpy Old Men. I remember the trailer. These movies on all the movie channels and even like the TV guide, they would just play these trailers on repeat. Mm-hmm. And it was like Hit the Road Jack, I think was in either the trailer or like the clips for this from Grumpy Old Men and Grumpy Old Men. I think Sophia Loren is in, I think she's in Grumpy Old Men. She's in one of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is the first time like a lot of the memories of these things and the movies that came out are through like clips and images or moments. Less me remembering actual plot points and like what happened in the film, but more so remembering that they existed when they were released.
Yeah, that's the funny thing about nostalgia and time. But what's also odd about it, I don't want to wax too philosophical or anything like that, but it's weird how much like we retain the core feeling of a movie when we cannot, if put to test, recall a single moment from a movie. Like I think I really understand the vibe of Grumpy Old Men. I understand its ethos. I understand like a tinge of its humor. And yet I can't like actually if I was forced to cite a single scene explicitly, which is so bizarre. I remember them fishing a lot. I do remember like the bait and tackle shop. I just remember, you know, the tone, the jocular curmudgeonliness of their characters and finding it quite charming. Another movie we brought up already a few times is Tom and Huck. It's one I think we've all seen in theaters. I definitely remember this. It was at the height of Jonathan Taylor Thomas hysteria in the 90s. The funny thing for me about this movie is I so remember the scene where Huck is painting the fence and tricks everyone else to paint the fence for him. And I remember that being just like such a signature scene in my childhood of like cleverness of getting out of work, of like pretending like something you don't like is good to convince others to do it for you. Mm-hmm. And then I remember thinking how polar opposite that is of this scene in Karate Kid, where it's teaching you that like the process is everything, you know, the wax on, the wax off, but he also does the fence painting. So I had these two like world views giving to me in these two like seminal childhood flicks that were diametrically opposed. And I just remember that cognitive dissonance from these two movies. So I think it's really funny how like films are like this strange pedagogical thing in our lives. And, you know, they could really confuse kids when you get like two kids movies with similar traits and a similar scene, even piece by piece, giving you a totally different moral lesson. So just a weird tidbit. What is your memories about Tom and Huck?
I remember going, I definitely saw some theaters and that was another big age or movies in general, like around this time, remembering where you saw and who you were with. And maybe the feeling that you had less so than the actual like moments of a movie. Like this guy, 95, I remember seeing Apollo 13 in theaters. And that was a huge experience for me. I was really overwhelmed and like scared by, I mean, the scale of that movie was really impressive at the time. I haven't revisited it. I imagine it still holds up. And Ron Howard directed that and that cast is great. But I remember seeing that night. And then there were a lot of films like this coming out. Like Disney was making kind of like Angels in the Outfield had a feel like this, or a King in King Arthur, or a Kid in Kid Arthur's Court or something with another title. They were like these Disney movies with kids, but they kind of felt real or like a little bit darker. And this was one of them. I remember seeing it theaters. I really like Brad Renfro. I think passed away at a pretty young age, and he passed away at 25. He was a great like prodigy. He had a small role in Ghost World, where he's like the 7-Eleven attendant, and he's really funny in that. And yeah, Jonathan Taylor Thomas. I mean, the mania was real around him just because of Home Improvement. Another show like that I didn't watch, but you always either watch the show after or before it, or it was always on TV. So you ended up watching like minutes here and there.
Tool Time. But,
oh yeah. Yeah, that was a big 95 was a huge movie going year for me, and like a kind of a turning point where I was actually going, I think my dad, a bunch of these are friends, but it was kind of a graduation point from being in Nebraska, where I was seeing a lot of, I guess I was like what, four or five, and watching like Disney movies. I remember like Beauty and the Beast and Sleeping Beauty, and now it was like a little bit grown up stuff, like Harriet the Spy, and you know, slightly more grown up, but then also Sudden Death, which was on cable a few years later.
Awesome. How about you, Jordan? Do you remember this one?
Tommy Hook, I remember actually being like, it had a twinge of terror in it that's not in a lot of Disney movies, like that scene where they're getting chased in a cave and stuff like that. I remember them being like blood brothers and cutting hands with a knife and stuff like that. I don't know why that's a scene that always stuck out to me. And the biggest thing I remember is like, I only remember there was like Huckleberry Finn before this. It's a much more serious movie, like much more like the book, really like tackles slavery and like all that. This was like more of like aimed at like kids kind of in the trailers, right? I remember it had like some kind of pop song or rock song that really got you to go with it. It was all about advertising that, like we said, that Jonathan Taylor Thomas is in this. I remember actually watching it. I was like, well, there's a lot of like intense scenes here. That's one thing I remember, because I only saw it in theaters. I never watched this one when it came out. This is one of those few Disney movies I didn't really go back to. I just saw it in theaters and kind of liked it. Yeah. So I'd be down to watch this again, because I had not seen it since I was like a kid in a theater.
Yeah, my funny anecdote is that I brought up that Tommy Hook was the one I just made up as my lie for seeing Sudden Death, but it couldn't have been, because I remember seeing it so distinctly with my parents, especially when you brought up the bloody hand scene where they cut their hands. So now I'm like racking my brain for what movie I would have possibly.
I'm going to guess Jumanji.
That would have been
out before, and we really liked it, and I wouldn't be surprised if we said we're going to go see it again, because we used to do that a lot. Like, see, I would not be surprised, because I legitimately liked Jumanji a lot when it came out. I probably would have been like, let's go see that.
Oh yeah, we loved it. We even bought the board game and all that. Yeah, we were a huge fan.
The video cassette that kind of opened up for the box.
Yeah, it's such a cool, elaborate looking game.
So legit scary movie, like good movie, also pretty scary.
Yeah,
like,
for real. Definitely. Yeah, it had such good action and, like you said, great tension. Me and my fiance were just talking about how Jumanji is kind of like a scary movie, like for kids.
Yeah.
I also love that you brought up Apollo 13. I mean, that was such an important movie of my childhood experiences. I saw that on 4th of July, and it kind of ruined that year's 4th of July. I was so moody after. It made me so emo. And then
existential after seeing it.
Oh, surreally so. Like, in such a surreal way, man. It hit me like so hard in feels.
I feel like you, because it changed my conception of space. I'm such a sci-fi kid and love Star Wars and X-Men space, everything but space I fucking love. If that was such a real space, I remember I was like, I'll never want to be no fucking astronaut after watching that movie. Like, I'm like, I'm all about fantasy space. Fuck the real space.
I mean, and it's rousing and a feel-good ending, but it just like had so much emotion that it just stuck with me.
It was very heavy for...
And we had the best 4th of July because, I mean, relevant for Sudden Death, what we'd do is we'd throw on our rollerblades and light firecrackers and skate and jump over them all day. I mean, we were pretty wild. So it was definitely like a mixture of hockey and street ball and fireworks and all that stuff. So, I mean, we always were so hyper and stoked, and that was the strangest
year. Rollerblades on. Like, one thing I remember about this year is like, I wore shoes to school and then I wore rollerblades like the rest of the time. It was always just playing like street hockey all the time.
Yeah. I mean, we wore those rollerblades down to shoes almost. Our wheels would get stripped to the bearings. We played so much. But let's continue with this list. We got a few more really fun ones. I'm looking at right now Dracula Dead and loving it. And I'm a big Mel Brooks fan. I mean, I love them all. Blazing Saddles, the Naked Gun ones. This one I've never seen. I've never seen it. I actually didn't even know it existed. I'll be straight honest until right now, like when I was, you know, doing this research. And I just want to then hear your two cents. Have you either of you heard of it? And if so, have you seen it? And if so, what are your recollections of it?
I think, well, before we kind of talking about this, both of us kind of, I don't know about you, but for me, it's the trailer. It's just, I remember Mel Brooks rising out of like a coffin, and then he hits his head on something, if I remember right. I think that was like the joke. And then sets up, like you said, a perfect Mel Brooks movie. I, like you mentioned, Naked Gun. Like, my dad worked on, I think, Naked Gun, which one had a half number in or something like that, right? So I was always kind of like familiar with that genre, and particularly his, like, Mel Brooks and Leslie Nielsen. But this is one, like you said, I don't think I've seen this one. The one that came after it, I think, is the one I remember seeing, which, drawing a blank on which one that one was. But yeah, this is definitely a blind spot. So I'm going to say this is the one I want to use my ticket for, I think, on this one. I'd want to go to the theater and actually see this one.
Awesome. I love that. We got one out. So Jordan's going to Dracula Dead and loving it. Matt, what about you? Do you have any memories with this one? Have you seen it?
I've never seen it. And if I have, it must have been like in parts. But I do remember the trailer again, like Jordan mentioned distinctly. And this was kind of peak Leslie Nielsen. Or maybe not. I don't know if it was the peak. But he had a couple after this, right? Mr. Magoo, Wrongfully Accused. And he was like making these like spoof films.
There's another spy one I can't think of.
Yeah, Spy Hard.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to think. Yeah, yeah. That, thank you.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah, that came after. That was legit. That was like a James Bond spoof. Yeah, or something.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah. And this one had its, I think, moments I remember. Even from the trailer, it was funny. I mean, having a movie built around Leslie Nielsen, to think of that happening like now, or someone of that like age and stature, is like, yeah, you know, shocking and mind-boggling. The fact that we had films just dedicated around him and just like hooking up with these older women who are attractive, or just getting in these ridiculous scenarios like this film was. That was kind of cool. And that was very 90s.
Oh, totally.
Super 90s. We're down to two. So we have Four Rooms. And this one I've seen more recently. It's a ton of fun. I really love Tim Roth as Ted the Bellhop. Definitely an iconic character. I always loved Tim Roth. Antonio Banderas is fun in it. I always like Tarantino when he's in movies. I mean, sometimes you could tell he's not that good, but I just am so entertained by Tarantino, like no matter what. Maybe it's just because what he means, he's such a formative cinephile of our generation. And so like his love of movies is just always oozing from him. Like
it's contagious.
It's contagious. He embodies it, that even when he's bad, it's just like, you know how much he loves being in the movie and you love it for that. So I'm not saying he's bad either. It's just like, it's hard to even cut through the like the reality of whether he's good or bad, because he's Tarantino. He's so iconic for me. But I mean, it is one of the weird ones where it's a joint directorial venture, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know all the directors, but I know Tarantino does a part. I think Robert Rodriguez. What are your memories of this one, and where does this one sit? Have you seen it recently?
I've never seen this actually, and I love the cast. And yeah, I remember it being a four-parter. I remember when it came out, it was advertised. And Allison Anders, who was a big independent film director at the time, Robert Rodriguez, Alexander Rockwell, who was another kind of these indie guys who came out or emerged out of Sundance in the early 90s. These were people who were benefiting from basically that the Sundance of like 92 was a big year for all four of these directors. And I've seen clips from it. Is the Top Gun scene where Tarantino is explaining like the theory of the Top Gun's a homoerotic movie? I don't think it's from this one.
I think that's from a slightly different one, but that's the same era for sure.
Okay, yeah. That was like my best friend's party or something. Mm-hmm, so.
Exactly. Yeah, that was it. Yeah. This one definitely has a screwball comedy vibe. It's kind of a black comedy. It's kind of a farce. I remember thinking it's kind of in weird ways similar to Clue, maybe just because the bellhop and like in how big a character in Clue, the what would you call that character? Not the valet, but he's kind of like the chaperone, or who's the main, the most iconic character in Clue?
Tim Curry or John Cleese?
Tim Curry. Okay, yeah. What's his role in that movie? Like what's his professional role? Because he's like the butler, right? He's the butler. Right.
I think so.
That feels embarrassing how long it took for me to grow up after that word. But anyways, Jordan, have you seen this one?
Yeah, I saw it when I was like 22 or 23. It's kind of like homework, a Tarantino movie I hadn't seen yet. I had heard of, and yeah, watched it, and I remember liking it, and I've only seen it once. And as you guys talk about it, I realized, like, we just kind of mentioned earlier, like, I don't remember anything about this movie. For most part, I remember there was a bellhop, I remember four different directors, I remember laughing, and like I said, I remember liking it, but I never came back to watch this. This isn't like Kill Bill or Pulp Fiction or Inglourious Basterds like that for me. So yeah, I guess it, I won't say I didn't like it, but it just didn't stick with me at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's one that I think for everyone is this anomaly in Tarantino's career. It's so early on, right? Mm-hmm. And it has such a cult classic following simply because anything that's connected to Tarantino does. But I just remember them running around like an old hotel and like crazy stuff happening, mm-hmm. like shenanigans happening.
I definitely remember seeing, like, even watching it, feeling like it felt like homework though. Like I was watching it because it was Tarantino and like I had to do it kind of thing. I remember that sounds like kind of negative, but it wasn't. Like
similar. Yeah. It was similar. Like you're going down the rabbit hole of an auteur you love, but it's not up to like their normal level of quality. And so it's just kind of a charming endeavor, but something that feels also kind of perfunctory or obligatory to a degree. Not that either, right? I'm dissing it too in a way that it doesn't need to be.
Yeah, right. It's hard to like elevate without putting it down.
Yeah, it's hard to qualify it. But moving on, the last one, Cutthroat Island. And this one has a wild discrepancy between its budget and its domestic box office gross. This must be one of the biggest box office busts of all time.
I believe it used to have the Guinness record for it. I don't know if it still does, but that's one of the things I used to remember it for.
I did not know that at all.
Yeah, it's another one with had a lot of marketing behind it too. I remember this is one of those ones that had tons of commercials out in sports. Like we're talking about sports here today. That was one of those ones on the sports weekends you'd see all the time that was trying to get the kids audience. I remember it was aimed for us, but no one wanted to see anything with pirates if it wasn't Hook or like had to do with Peter Pan. I remember this time. So like it was just doomed to be a flop. I remember seeing it as like it was supposed to be for our age group and had no interest in going and seeing it at that time. But I know that now it's kind of getting a little bit of a cult following for, I guess, how, I don't know how bad it is, or if it's just, it wasn't, no one really watched it at that time.
Yeah. I mean, 98 million budget, which was a lot, especially in 95, and it grossed 10 million. They like gave up on it, like almost right away. It's pretty bananas. And it's, you know, just a pirate movie, and it maybe laid the foundation for Pirates of the Caribbean, or maybe like that was like the saving grace of pirate movies. I don't know. It's interesting that like that was such a worldwide hit. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but that's what got to be one of the best box office successes in the last 50 years.
You're talking about the Pirates of the Caribbean movies, right?
Yeah, I'm talking about this. I switched gears. The Johnny Depp vehicle.
The first one.
And yet here's this other big pirate experiment, Cutthroat Island with Gina Davis. I actually don't know who else is in it that well. Matthew Modine?
Matthew Modine.
Yeah.
Frank Langella.
I like him always. And who directed it? Was it Remy Harlan. All right. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah. It was a great, you know, one of the better, I'm sure we'll get into kind of the action directors and what a great era the 80s and 90s were for them and those kind of films. Remy Harlan was like at the top of that list. And if you think about Long Kiss Goodnight, which he directed a year after this, Cliffhanger, he did the second Die Hard movie. And so it was, you know, really impressive. Did a bunch of these sequels, but they're like really good sequels that might as well have been the first movie. Uh-huh. I mean, they were that good quality.
Driven. I love Driven. I'm like a huge champion of that one, which was one of Stallone's mid-career now. It felt like a second coming, I guess, for Stallone.
He's had a few of those in our lifetime.
Yeah, but I'll just throw it down right now. This is where my ticket's going. This is where my $5 is going. Cutthroat Island. I want to boost this box office. I want to see this on the big screen. I have not seen it to this day. I think I'm going to try to catch this in the next month. It's going to the top of my queue. I mean, I'm peaked. I'm really interested in this now. I didn't know much about it. Have either of you seen it?
No, I haven't.
No, because this was the same year as Waterworld, but it was like an unsuccessful, not so bad, it's bad movie. It's like no one even like paid attention. They're like, Waterworld's our C movie with ridiculous cast.
Yeah,
they're both 95 movies. And I do remember reading like Cutthroat Island was the movie that bankrupted Caralco Pictures. Basically, it was the last film that they released. And this is like a company that was around since the 70s and distributing films. And they did like Showgirls the same year, which also was a huge bomb. And Basic Instinct and Narrow Margin, Total Recall. So this movie like was, you know, a big effect on a company that kind of changed the like high genre filmmaking for like 30 years. So yeah,
this was a great breakdown, by the way. This was such a fun weekend. I love these 90s weekends that don't have like, I don't know, the biggest juggernaut films that we remember like right away, like the Titanics, but that have all of these slightly niche ones that have also stood the test of time, that are like right in the back of our brains. And so at the end of the day, Jordan, you're going to Dracula Dead, loving it. I'm going to Cutthroat Island. And Matt, you haven't chosen Nixon or Waiting to Exhale.
Because I've seen Waiting to Exhale and it was great, I'm going to go with Nixon just because people say it's good and it doesn't get the love that JFK does, even though they came out a few years apart. So Nixon all the way.
Nice. Good choice. Yeah, I like that they're all first-time viewings too, right? Mm-hmm. That makes it exciting too. Because my first instinct was Grumpier Old Men because I want to like revisit it and see if it lives up to like how fond I was of it. But I like this idea of Cutthroat Island. So now pivoting to the main event, the sudden death event, our film of the night. I mean, I want to use all this superlatives I can, and I'm flailing here. But Sudden Death is a 1995 action thriller directed by Peter Hyams, and we've already mentioned a few of the things. It's a huge vehicle for Jean-Claude Van Damme. Many people view it as his best film ever. Maybe not his most iconic. I mean,
yeah,
we could debate that. But
he has a lot more iconic roles in this one.
Yeah, what would you call his most iconic role?
Oh, what's his name? John Duke and I might have the name wrong, but the dude from fucking Bloodsport. Like, Bloodsport for me is just a dope-ass movie. I'm a huge Mortal Kombat fan, and obviously that takes a lot from Bloodsport, and, like, there's a huge inspiration behind that, but that's a big one for me. Another one not widely held by him, but I did like the second one, is Universal Soldier. That's one that I think is one of his better roles. Actually, he's known for being Guile, weirdly, which is not his best role, but Guile from Street Fighter, right? Yeah, he's had so many, like, dope-ass ones. But I also like him as a boxer in Lionheart, like the Street Fighter in Lionheart. It's probably my favorite of his movies, though. I think that's one of the best Van Damme movies. It has a lot of what we have here with him, obviously being that one more about actual like fighting, but him always doing it for like a family or a kid or some kind of family tie to it, like very Fast and Furious, right?
Totally. How about you, Matt? Do you have any favorite Van Damme movies or movies you put above this as like, this is a Van Damme movie?
I like that this movie, I think this movie stands out more than any of his others in that it's kind of like a regular guy and he's not doing like his signature splits and he's not kicking everyone's ass and it's not assumed that he's going to be the guy who steals the movie.
I remember, do you remember going and seeing this, Paul? Because like, we're kind of getting into it. Like you mentioned, that's one thing I remember going into this. I was expecting classic Van Damme, like martial arts. And there's almost none in this. Like none of his kicks are like the spin kicks. Like you said, the splits or him like elbowing. It's all like MacGyver kills and a couple like drop kicks in there. And I remember not really being let down by it, but like just totally being surprised. Because Van Damme was one of my favorite action heroes as a kid. Him and Schwarzenegger, Stallone too, of course. But I think Van Damme in the 90s is probably my favorite for some reason. I think it was because of his style of karate or whatnot, the way it looked on screen. But yeah, seeing him like being like this like working class Joe, just dummying dudes behind the scenes. It like built it added to his heroism to me.
I mean, I love that he's just a meat and potatoes dad here, firefighter too. I love the fact that he's a civil servant, right? Like he's someone who helps society, and all the bad guys in the film are CIA agents who are like supposed to help society, but they're connected to the government. As I say that, right? Firefighters are technically connected to the government, but on a different level. So like there's this feeling of like a cynicism or a distrust that lingers or hovers over this movie. And some of this movie feels very 1970s-esque. It has that 70s vibe. There's these 90s movies to me. A lot of these diehard copy movies, right? The diehard clones, as we call them, have that sensibility and ethos. And this one definitely does. A bit of it is that Pittsburgh setting. And Matt, you wrote really intriguingly about this setting. Most of it is inside of one place, the Pittsburgh Civic Arena. But the first 15 minutes or so, they do a lot of establishing shots of the city. It really sets the character of this blue collar city. Of this, is that a Protestant city? I mean, I remember there's one shot, it's on a hill. There's a lot of like Gothic brick and mortar type buildings and cathedrals, and there's a big bridge. If you want to give a little bit, I don't want to put you too much on the spot, of the topography of Pittsburgh and the sensibility and how you think it kind of infuses this film with some character.
For sure. But to answer your other question, Hard Target, directed by John Woo, and Sudden Death, my top two Jean-Claude movies. Yeah, I mean, the city of Pittsburgh really plays a big role here, and a large part as to why is Peter Hyams directing, and he's the cinematographer on this film, which is really unique among any films, like big budget level studio or indie films. Very rarely will you see the director also be the DP on the film. Like, for example, nowadays, Soderbergh is kind of the only one who does it. He's gotten better. I think early on in Soderbergh's career, like the cinematography was like a little dodgy. It didn't look as good. But Peter Hyams really films cleanly. It's kind of one of the aspects of this film that really stands out. Like Pittsburgh looks beautiful. It's like a June night and the sun's going down. He manages to like capture, you kind of get where you are. It's kind of like this Rust Belt blue collar town. You're immediately there. And all it took was like you said, a couple establishing shots.
Yeah.
As we see like the crooks hunt down, and that was really well done too. Like that whole, you know, only in like a couple minutes, we see all like the henchmen do their thing, like along the river with the bridge in the backdrop. They just like shoot up someone. And then they go and take the grandma or the wife of the chef, the cook hostage. And again, it looks very Pittsburgh-y too. Yeah, the hills, he was able to take advantage of things that the city does so well, and the reason it's so cinematic and not a lot of like filmmakers have taken advantage of those aspects over the, you know, the past 30, 40 years, but he did.
It's just a good setup before you get to the stadium too, because it's like so rooted in, like you said, this like city outscape, and then it's like this not suburban section, but the, you know, where the home is, and it's got them playing ice hockey, and then the surprise of the tickets with the countdown. I love the countdown of the game, like 4 hours to the game, 2 hours to puck drop, right? Like you said, it works with all the terrorist stuff going on, but it works as well with like him getting his tickets, rushing home, and then the conflict, if you will, of him and the stepfather or whatnot, right? Exchanging custody, all that kind of on the goal, and like the excitement of the kids of like, are we going to get going to the game, right? I love that. Like the idea of like, here's some tickets, we're doing this thing, now we're going to this. It's such, very frankly, I've never had someone like, yeah, who's gotten like surprise tickets or something. It's kind of exciting. It really is. Even as an adult, it's still fun. And I love the way like it just encapsulates like the special, like how unique that moment is, the game seven, the city behind it. I love the whole setup because it really leads you to the stadium without, you know, driving through traffic and all that stuff of reality.
Yeah, I mean, and they got so many of these 90s narratives set up really quickly, especially like paternal centered narratives where you have he's not a fuck up dad, but the divorcee, right? Yeah. Who is got tension with his ex-wife, and he's amicable actually with the new father figure in the kid's life, or at least the new stepdad. But you know, we're sensing all that as adult viewers, right? This like this breach of protocol, right? Where he didn't bring up these tickets. And so what it's doing is you're getting all of this responsibility put on Jean-Claude Van Damme's shoulders, right? His character's shoulders in this one moment. And it also adds to the inciting scene, right? Because like Cliffhanger, right? And like a lot of these diehard clone movies, they have to start off with a tragic incident, some sort of a moment of a mental lapse or a physical lapse or just a freak accident that haunts our masculine heroic figure and that kind of sits deeply and darkly in their psyche. And in here, we get a firefighting scene where he's trying to save a young girl, probably, I don't know, 7 years old, and he doesn't succeed. That was probably like the only poorly shot thing in the whole movie, is the girl so obviously a doll when she's dead. I was like so thrown off by that. That was the only thing that really took me out. I was like, why is it a doll? Is this humor? I my brain went like five different directions at once, and I was just like, no, this is the 90s, and that was not a good simulation of a corpse. But no, that was all really nice setup. But then they have the baddies, as you said, along the river, you know, killing the guys. I love this double entendre of the title. Maybe it's just more relevant in 90s heist kind of adult action flicks than I remember. But today we linger and we draw out these deaths. And there's some of that in the fight sequences. But so many of the deaths in this movie are so suddenly. So I was just thinking sudden death, right? Like the way they murder the chef's wife, the old lady who has the Fig Newton's joke and so forth, right? I mean, the way the baddies roll into the box office suite where the vice president is and just start shooting people up is just like uninhibited. It's unabashedly fast. And there's something really kind of jolting about it, but thrilling about it. I was like so on board with how they didn't just draw out these things and dilate them unnecessarily. So I thought that was just an utter blast with the killings. But what I also love though is establishing shots around the stadium. And this movie, I think, is one of the most interesting sports movies because it really gets into the nitty-gritty of the operational protocols and preparations and just the convoluted labyrinthian process of running a sports event, right? I feel like this really understands the industrial aspect of that building. And so I was wanting to know what both of you thought about that aspect and how they set up that with the popcorn, just with the steamy back rooms, with, you know, the chefs where they're cooking the meals for the people. I mean, a lot of this movie, it's not taking place on the ice or even in the stands, right? It's in these corridors and shadowy back rooms and in the elevators, right? It's in the ugly, you know, basements and attics. And I love that about this. It's really, really clever.
Yeah. One thing I remember as a kid, when they go in through the back entrance, it threw me back to when we were kids after the Kings games and they used to play at the Forum, and we'd wait to the back entrance to go get autographs. This is like, you can't do this anymore at the Staples Center, but we'd go wait, and it's like that kind of giant driveway where they're doing the check-in and sudden death. But we'd wait for them and they'd come out, right? And we'd always know the hockey players because they'd be like in suits and they have just these gorgeous women with them. That's why we'd always see, and we'd be like, they're hockey players. They have no teeth and they've got hot girls with them. So we gotta go get their autographs, right? But this is like the other side of that, right? It was like you said, the work function. So it was like behind the scenes. I always was super fascinated by that. Just that giant corridor shot. Like you said, it gives you another look at it. But from a kid's perspective, I was like, oh, that's the entrance to like, but it's like a magical kingdom when you're a kid, like that's where the arena is. And like, so for me, this was like a first time look, if you will, like behind the scenes, right? When they get to that scene with Luke Robitaille in the locker room and he's speaking French to Jean-Claude Van Damme, right? I remember that vividly, one of the first times as a kid reading subtitles and reading the word fuck and reading it in its full context where he says, we're going to fuck him up, and just dying laughing because I'm a huge Luke Robitaille fan. And in my kid's head, I can never imagine Luke Robitaille ever saying the word fuck, right? So I remember it stuck with me. I'm like, oh man, it's just this funny line. The delivery of Jean-Claude Van Damme, when he tells his son, no, he said, no, they're going to play hard or whatever. He doesn't tell him what he really said, just always just really stuck me with what hockey kind of is, right? There's this like toughness and grit to it. There's this also this, like weird like family values and family sheen to it where you want to still protect your kids from it, even though they're going to play that game. I loved it, that scene. It's just a real like realness to it that's always stuck with me. And even watching it this time around, it still, that nostalgic note still hit pretty hard.
Yeah, I love the, first of all, his name's Darren McCord. Even though he's like speaking French Canadian, he apparently played hockey. He tells the players in the locker room in Canada at some point, he used to be a goalie. My dad was a goalie. And the guy who plays Brad Tolliver is Jake Caulfield, who was like a instigator, agitator guy in those 90s teams. And now he's the like post-game broadcast guy for the Penguins. He works for them. He's like this huge dude.
Yeah. He used to be like Mario Lemieux's like trainer when he was making his comeback.
Right. Yeah. He's like this huge dude. Literally, he was just there to enforce and protect the superstars if they got hit or hurt. But yeah, the way in which they show, first of all, this movie's so quick and it moves at such a rapid pace. It's almost 2 hours long, but it's really lean and efficient. There's not a lot of wasted scenes, and the cheesy scenes don't seem that cheesy. And like you said, I like that the divorced dad trip, the guy, the stepdad kind of looks, he's like nice to Van Damme. He's like, oh, your dad has an important job. He's a fire inspector. He's like totally like lobbying this guy as he's about to pick them up and steal them. But yeah, they're playing hockey, and the whole showing of the maintenance workers, the security guards, the whole schematic and like logistics of getting into a stadium and who gets in and using like the back entrance, the back door, the security entrance to get in, and all those like nice guys that like stamp your hand. And that came back to this movie really shrewdly kind of used those small knickknacks that you kind of have to have, and or it's so often used, it's such a big trope. But here it was like the squirt gun that his son has, and then he uses it later on when he kills one of the agents.
One of the sicker kills in the movie too.
Yeah, what a crazy kill.
I always love that one. Like MacGyver, just MacGyverism.
Yeah, just super MacGyver. And there's so many like ridiculous, I think, aspects of the film, but one, the pacing of it, and because there's so much going on and how he mixes in. First of all, the vice president is there. And there's a great Letterboxd review I came across rather by Matt Lynch, who has like 46,000 Letterboxd followers. I'm not sure how that's possible to have that many. But he had a great review where he's like, Sudden Death is second-rate Die Hard almost to a T. It's not the president, it's the vice president. It's not Bruce Willis, it's Jean-Claude Van Damme. It's not LA, it's like Pittsburgh, you know, instead of any other city. And there is like a second-rateness to it, but it's almost more exciting. And it's so well done. The hockey scenes that are interjected and kind of intercut between it kind of add to the, I don't know, intensity of the movie itself. And I think Jean-Claude is really, his acting in this movie is really good, because a lot of times he's had to rely on his like physical prowess and his physique in general. And here it's kind of this down on your rights kind of dad who is a fire inspector, has two kids, and he's trying to get over this past tragedy that happened to his life. And he's suddenly, you know, not the guy or not the one people are relying on. And he does a really good job of selling that role. Oftentimes, I think he's really well cast in this. And obviously, Powers Booth is the villain in a movie like this. You know, it's not Hans Gruber, it's not Alan Rickman. But as far as the next kind of like list of actors up for this role, Powers Booth is like the guy you want in this era. And he's really good.
He's so good. I love that you brought that up. I was going to just about to bring that up as well. If you want to do the second tier, right? Powers Booth is perfectly the second tier from Alan Rickman. And that's not an insult. That's not in any way slanderous statement. There's something slightly charming about this like second tier nature of everything. This B movie nature of all of the qualities of this. I think that's why it's become such highly like endorsed and championed and defended Die Hard clone movie. Mm-hmm. And it's so well done. It moves at such a fast clip. And Jordan, you brought up that even before the game, we have the clock countdown, right? 4 hours before, 90 minutes before. I love the 90 minutes. It's this exterior shot of the Civic Arena. They do so many good shots outside of it, right? Because it really is this dome. And I know so many of them are domes, but it has just an ominous look to it. Really quickly, before I jump in a little bit more into my elaborations of what you said, Matt, have you ever been to a game in that arena? Is it still there? Have they renovated it or have they moved arenas? The Pittsburgh Penguins. I want to know this.
Yeah, they destroyed that. Now it's a parking lot. And the new arena that they built, PPG Paints, is literally across the street. I think you're right. Like this arena, Jean-Claude talked about in an interview. This is the only arena in North America that had a retractable roof that you could open up. And that was such a key part of the last third of the scene, the last third of set piece with the helicopter going down, which was a real helicopter. It took 2 days to shoot that. And they used a real helicopter that blew up because they had to have the fire. They had like 12 cameras apparently going at the same time. And that's kind of, again, that's Peter Himes. And it's interesting that I have been to games at the Igloo. I think I saw a Ricky Martin concert there. And I went to a bunch of Penguins games. Like that was Jagr, late Lemieux, that 98 to 2002, Alexei Kovalev. Like there were a lot of highly skilled players. It was a very intimate feel. Like arenas aren't built like that anymore. The crowd feels like it's on top of the stadium. It's not like spread out as much. You feel much more tightly knit, and it would get cold. And there was an iconic kind of aspect of the arena, like the fact that it was old, so old school, and they weren't destroying it. And you felt like you were in an igloo, and it looked like one too. Yeah. But it was awesome to go to games there. So seeing this movie also brings back memories of like another time. And also you're talking about the establishing shots, Paul, and like all the helicopters like zooming in and out, like the cameras rotating with the cops standing outside. I don't know how he was able to like coordinate all this. It's really, really well done, really impressive. Yeah.
And the retractable roof is absolutely essential for this movie to work. I mean, when I was rewatching it last night, I think the most memorable scene still where like I like sat up again is when Jean-Claude Van Damme, you know, like rappels down into like the Jumbotron, right? And it's exploding, right? You know, as they're going into overtime, or they're in overtime at this point, but like just those moments, right? The use of the Jumbotron earlier, the use of the Zamboni, all the clever ways they use these hockey props, right? I love that the Zamboni dumps all the dead bodies onto the police force.
That movie like scarred like the next three times I went to like a hockey game. We used to sit up at the top and it's like right above those old school scoreboards that were like a cube. I'd be like, man, if this shit goes down, we're going to see some stuff. Like, so I'd always be watching the game and like occasionally look up like, is anything going on up there? I remember like two games after that at the Kings Forum, just being obsessed with like sudden death here or whatever.
I also do love that you brought up like the way it shrewdly used the squirt gun and the stamp, right? It has a lot of Chekhov's guns here, right? If we want to use that term. These things that appear in the first act and boy, you know, they're going to appear in the third act, but they do it in a really savvy way. They're very astute about that. The other thing that you wrote, Matt, in your article, and we haven't even mentioned it explicitly yet, that you wrote a really amazing article on this film. Kind of on Pittsburgh as well. And you could shout that out as well in your answer right here, because I'm going to ask you a question. Is you wrote a lot about the writer and how that gave them access to this venue. So I'll let you tell our listeners a little bit about that and also tell them about your article.
Yeah, sure. The article I wrote was for Pittsburgh Orbit, and it was like a local website that I wanted to write about this movie because it was turning 25 and it was COVID. And I was like, this movie's kind of great. I want to commemorate it. And it's a lot better than I remember it being. I think I saw it that year. And I'm like, this is really high quality.
I appreciate you doing that too. Like, thank you. Right. That was a good article. And like you said, this is a movie that like deserves a little light on it every once in a while.
Yeah, exactly. And it's Die Hard, deservedly so. I think it's just like a better movie. But as far as the ripoffs go, this should be in a conversation like with Speed, with Under Siege. It's every bit as good as those movies, maybe even better. Not Speed, but I think you can make the argument it's better than Under Siege. But yeah, the writing backstory is crazy because the team was owned at the time by Howard Baldwin, who was a hockey fanatic, and he owned a bunch of like minor league franchises and started them in Connecticut and Hartford and Wilkes-Barre, the Penguins minor league team. And he was married to an actress/producer, Karen Baldwin. And this was her story. She came up with the story. And they pitched it to Peter Hyams, the director. And he's like, yeah, no hockey arena is going to let us do this. This sounds insane. And she's like, oh, by the way, we own the Penguins. He's like, oh, okay, that could work. And I think they wanted to film it during a Penguins game. They got permission from the NHL to film it during a Blackhawks Penguins game in October of like 94. And then the lockout happened. The strike happened. Mm-hmm. And then they had to like do it was an exhibition game between like the Erie or the Cleveland Lumberjacks and the Penguins in 94. So people were like taking it seriously, but kind of not really. And they were supposed to wear a Blackhawks jersey. Yeah, the backstory is kind of wild. I mean, how many kind of co-owner spouses or co-owners in general like write a movie that comes to fruition and becomes a hit? It's also kind of cool that Jean-Claude, he kind of wrote a list of directors that he wanted to work with in the 90s. At the top was Ridley Scott, who he never got a chance to work with. But number two was Peter Hyams. And when Peter Hyams found out, he's like, yeah, no way. That's not true. But Peter Hyams' buddy was Andrew Davis, who directed The Fugitive and Above the Law and Code of Silence. And he's like, hey, you directed the best movies with like Steven Seagal and Chuck Norris. Why can't I do that with Jean-Claude? And I think in many ways, he kind of pulled it off. And the backstory is insane. And also, we talked about Chekhov's guns. How about like the use of Iceberg, the mascot?
Oh, dude.
That was phenomenal. Like the best like sports mascot villain in recent memory.
Oh yeah. One of the better fight scenes, like in Van Damme history. It's such an iconic one, actually. Like I said, like it's different than all of his other ones. It's much more, this is like use of the environment and all that, not just like the hands just dummying dudes. One of those ones that scarred me from Kitchens for a little bit, where I was scared of those dishwashing machines. It has this like tinge of horror to it. Like it is, went from action to like this like grotesque like kill. Like I love it. It's one of those one of the better like Van Damme kills, I think, in his career. But also on a side note, because we were talking about that, going back to like when we watched it, Paul, do you remember Robert, one of the older kids who went to go see it, like we're talking about the movie out there. They were like, the only thing that wasn't believable was that a girl could beat up Jean-Claude Van Damme. And my dad was like, no, I've actually worked with that girl at the, you know, he's a set painter. He's like, she would beat everyone up in this car and then some. Like, and she's like, and Van Damme. Like, Van Damme in real life is this big. He's like, she's bigger than all, you know, he kind of just schooled us on what like stunt people versus actors. You know, I just remember just always kind of being in awe for a second after that conversation.
I love that too, because he just like totally bullied the misogyny out of us right there as little kids, right? It's right. So dope. In late 90s, so woke and just like emasculating us in the best way. Anyways, yeah, the Iceberg kill is awesome. I was tweeting about it last night. Just deadly hilarious, deadly fun. And it kind of set the scene. I think so many fight sequences in the last 20 years have been set in kitchens with kitchen utensils, right? And going through the dishwasher at the end, having the other ones with his face on like the fryer, having like, what was it, a chicken bone or a steak bone or a T-bone steak thing going through his neck, right? Really fun culinary aligned death sequences in this movie that they were really big on like tying it up to somehow like gastronomy, right? They wanted all the kills or a lot of the kills to be set in the chef's room. There was this undercurrent of like with the chef being the one who was kidnapped right in the beginning. I mean, that was my favorite part, I think, of the whole setup too, is how they did hold his wife ransom and call him 30 seconds before they show up to have the head chef escort him up to the suite. I don't know. I really liked that. I thought that was really just like a unique kind of way of sneaking in. You know, we get the killings and the badges being stolen. That's pretty easy. And even having sort of insiders here and there. But that one really, yeah, I thought,
also brought that balance of like the humanity and like you feel sorry for them. And then he uses that to make a great joke about when he kills the chef. Well, he's a recent widow. He wouldn't have been happy anyways. It's like this tasteless joke, but so funny because it's delivered by this villain. I gotta say, like the one-liners and like you mentioned, like Van Damme's acting earlier, his delivery of these comedic lines as a dad are so perfect. And it's like, it's Van Damme. It's not, Van Damme's not like an everyday dad. Hell no, it's Van Damme. But one of the best ones, like I thought, was when he forgot which player he calls out. He's like, look at him, man. He's got eyes in the back of his head. He gets like dummied on the boards. And he's like, his eyes must be closed. it's at that point where the kids don't really like, dad's not a fireman anymore. You know, they don't trust him. He doesn't know everything in the world, I guess, at that point, which is like this weird little theme, right? It's punctuated here and there throughout it, right? But like, those are the moments that really sell it, when he's both dad you feel sorry for, but dad you're like laughing with too. I think he's so funny in this movie. It's just like, he's not really that funny in any of these movies. He has bad one-liners, but the one where he has the detonator, he tries to explain how the detonator works. Then he gets to use it again on the next guy he kills. It's just like, just pitch delivery for Van Damme. Like you said, it's so rare for him to really flex his acting skills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he wasn't even fluent fully in English at the time. He was still learning it, but it's almost, you know, naturalistic because he's French Canadian and this is a hockey movie and it kind of fits the mold of everything. He's Belgian, but he plays a French Canadian in the movie. But yeah, there are a lot of culinary related or adjacent kills. There was also like a weight room fight. So every aspect of that hockey arena felt used in the movie. Like every corner was picked out, including the box where the vice president was hanging out. By the way, vice president played by a great character actor, Raymond J. Barry, who was like Tom Cruise's dad and born on the 4th of July. And he was always like appearing in like 80s, 70s, 90s in small roles, but he's always really good. And yeah, I love the sequence when they're coming through the kitchen for the first time to go up to the box and the camera pans from the bottom to the top. It kind of travels up and it pans up and you got Powers Booth's like, you know, iconic face and that expression of like pure evil. And you see it early on in the film when we see him for the first time, when they're like gathering somewhere in the back alley of the arena. There's a timer and there's a clock and he's like, all right. And everyone like splits. And then this little stuffed animal blows up. The stuffed animal penguin blows up after 30 seconds.
I mean, going back to the use of the stadium, like you said, right? This use of the arena, it is just so perfectly in tuned with all like the semiotics of going to an event that's a sports event in a big space. And it really uses everything cleverly, right? The mascot is not just like a throwaway gag or joke, right? The mascot is integral to the film. The Jumbotron is a huge part of the film, right? It shows the sudden death words in big bold letters, right? The food you eat, right? The popcorn bags, like I already brought up, you know, let you know they're sneaking in stuff. And they do that in a really like winky way. I mean, it's obvious enough, but it's not too obvious that it's just like hitting you on the head with a sledgehammer. I really, really love that. I also, I'm with you 100%. The one-liners from Powers Booth are so hilarious, right? He is a perfect villain. I love that there's zero like real backstory or subtext about his scenario. All we know is that he's like a ex-CIA agent turned mercenary who's got this vendetta against the government and he's pretty much a nihilist. He has a line where I don't know exactly, maybe one of you can cite it word for word, but the line about like he wants world peace. Does anyone know that line for line? Because it's so funny.
Oh yeah, I have it here. He says, what do you want? He says, world peace and end to bigotry and no more mini malls. What am I gonna get? And I'm gonna get it. That boys and girls is really hot.
See, he's just so funny. And the way he sells and the way he delivers it, so deadpan, right? He's so utterly evil and he's just so suave about it. He's really great baddie.
Yeah. Dead heroes get the best funerals. That's another Powers Booth line in that movie.
Yeah. Another great line. I mean, I'm not going to say he's better than Hans Gruber, right? Because that would be blasphemous, but he's doing an excellent job with this role. This role is so much fun that like it'd be dumb to compare them. They're two great roles. I love that he just like the idea at that period of the 90s where they're trying to explain how money gets siphoned into like more and more accounts. I love that that's just so obvious today, but then it must have been like a really well-written line. Like, I mean, that's really smart and intelligent. And I just think that like what's funny is with Bitcoin and so forth, right? We have so many even deeper ways of hiding money and creating camouflage like accounts that it just felt a little dated. It didn't mean it felt bad. It just felt like, oh, this is very intelligent, but very much of the 90s. I think he does have a line about like, I wonder who's going to get the cup if I blow it up before the game is over, right? It's a great line. And I love the way that it's playing off the game. Too much of the game, for my opinion, maybe if I had one slight nitpick, felt too much of a secondary source to the action stuff. Like I wanted them to build up a little bit more of this competition of it's game seven of the Stanley Cup. I mean, we get a little bit of the broadcasters in the first and second period. We get all the goals, right? So they're keeping tally with the goals, but it feels like so much of a time card and it works really well. But I just wish we got a little bit more of like a rooting interest in the game that we actually cared about every time we saw the goals until the very end. And then it works. So once it hits like the halfway mark of that third period and we get the goalie being sick, and we get Jean-Claude getting in the arena and on the ice. I mean, then it kicks ass and it's amazing. And, you know, the last goal by Luc Robitaille is awesome. Yeah. It ties into the movie. But that, I guess that was if I had one slight little.
That's also kind of like where like the plot doesn't make any more sense anymore with like Jean-Claude Van Damme getting the bombs and then Powers Booth just not blowing him up. right? Which is his ultimate goal. But we don't care about it because it works so well with the periods lining up to like kill two people. You got to do this. But then when he gets that phone call, like you said, after that, it kind of doesn't matter because there's so much fun stuff going on with him jumping into like this booth and trying to blow it up and going back to it. Like at that point, it kind of doesn't make sense though, because like his whole plan is to just like, I guess, change his costume into cool disguise, but still escape by helicopter at the top of the thing, right? It's his ultimate escape plan, right? But that's like, it doesn't matter is my point. Because at the end, you're just like looking at what Van Damme's doing and then reusing that, those scenes we've seen, or sorry, the areas we've seen. But like, I agree with you, but I was rewatching it like, after the second period, like, or like you said, midway through the third period, it starts working to the film, right? I think the second time it took me out a little bit, I was like, okay, I see a little, I guess, a flaw, if you will. But it's so like fantastical what he's trying to accomplish to get into the box, right? I think as an age viewer, just like, it's such spectacle, you want to see it, right? And the way that it's executed, there's a lot of cool stunt work going on with some really bad like CGI green screen too. Right, which I thought was really cool. I was like blown away by the stunt work. But then when we see Van Damme's face, whatever, like the third period's really interesting, right? Because it's when all this shit's like hyping up, but it's weirdly like deconstructing the plot at the same time. But I think a good action movie, and that thinks this is one that does that, can distract you enough where it doesn't take you out of it. And you still want to see this full circle just come to conclusion. I think even the second time I was like still on board with that.
But yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about this point. And this is really interesting for us as we study the sports movie genre, right? Because this is a film that isn't just like an action film that has some sort of ancillary connection to a sports movie. This is one that is creating two parallel genres, and they're kind of running simultaneously here. And I found that really interesting. I found that they were coupling and pairing the momentum and crescendoing suspense and tension of an action movie. Just the story arc we've come to become so related to or attuned to, right? As seasoned moviegoers, right? As at-home cinephiles, we understand the formula of an action movie. We understand when it's building its suspense. And we also understand the development of a sports movie, right? The formula of a sports movie. And it really does a good job, especially in the third act, of tying them together, because with the augmenting tension and urgency of the game, we're getting the, you know, finale of all this action suspense, right? This crazy imbroglio that's going on with the bomb, the 10 bombs in the arena, right? And him trying to find them all. And I love just how much is going on with Jean-Claude Van Damme here. Like, he's doing so much that it's such a dynamic action hero role. Mm-hmm. I think in some senses, it's almost more dynamic than Bruce Willis in Die Hard. And I'm not trying to say that's a knock. I'm not trying to say like that's better, but it's just like it has more dimensions to it, where he's like, he's running through this arena all over trying to defuse bombs. He's fighting baddies. He's suddenly on the ice as the goalie, right? Then he's on the roof. Like, I mean, the dude is everywhere here. He's doing so much. And it's just a blast. And the fact that they set the topography and they map out this stadium so well that they keep it credible and believable, mm-hmm, is unreal. It's a fantastic job of directing this movie. Mm-hmm. And I think that is what like stunned me the most and made me think, wow, what a well-crafted action movie this is, that they like made this whole scheme within like an hour and 40 minutes and they made it believable and they kept it suspenseful. I just loved it. It was so well done in that sense. The temporal dynamics, the temporal nature of this movie. I mean, it's downright silly, of course. You know what I mean? It knows it's silly, but it's just so meticulously executed that I was just smiling ear to ear.
Yeah, and I think that's what someone like Peter Hyams, who's been a genre guy his whole career, who kind of elevates these B movies. I think he just wants to have a good time with the movies and be entertained. These are the types of movies that he likes to watch. And a lot of times those are the ones he made. And whether it was Capricorn One or The Relic with Tom Sizemore or End of Days, the movie oftentimes had like a ridiculous plot, but he played it so straight that it felt lived in and it felt real. And it felt much more legitimate and legitimized because of that. And you do get the sense that the stadium is another character, and it may be because it has to be, because so much of it's taking place there and the game's there. But there are movies where you don't really feel a sense of setting or any sense of where you are or where you're located. It kind of looks like a green screen, or there's like no audience in the crowd. And you're right that at some point, I think in the movie, maybe in the third period, you kind of lose track of the score. Like, okay, who's winning now? Like, who's scoring? Like, how are they up? But yeah, the plot of the movie where money needed to be distributed every period or he would shoot someone, that was kind of cool. Like, those two things were in tandem. And there were parallel movies going on. There was the hockey game on the ice, and then there was Van Damme running around. That was one of the kind of question marks that I have for the movie or unanswered questions is like, how did he even know these like little bombs? He somehow had a sixth sense where they were located in the whole stadium. I'm not even sure if he knew that stadium's topography as well he did. I know he was a fire inspector and he had to work there that night, but how he was able to manage, okay, he's like, this one's over there. And there's like a scene where he's underneath like some section and in the chairs and Powers Booth's on the phone with him. He's like, it's section C. Like, how does Powers Booth even know this stadium by heart?
He knows the sound of the boards, right? There's a check. He's like, I know those boards.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I've seen those
that,
boards.
He's that deep into it.
I mean, he has eyes in the back of his head, right? And they're not closed. Oh, man. That's funny.
But yeah, the scene you just alluded to, Paul, where like he goes on the ice as a goalie. It's kind of ridiculous, obviously, but you needed those two movies that were running in tandem eventually to meet and merge. And as ridiculous as it is, it also kind of added to that other element, which this film has so much of and so good at, is his relationship with his kids does feel legitimate. It does feel kind of, the stakes are real for whatever it means. Like his reputation with his son is damaged. His daughter really loves him and supports him. And she teaches him, again, another one of those Chekhov's.
The gun,
yeah. With the sign language that his daughter's learning, right? She like learns the I love you thing. And then he does it as a goalie. And she's like, holy shit. And then his son realized that's his dad. And that's like a big amount, like, oh, my dad's a big deal.
I love that. Yeah. I love that his son also, you know, I mean, I get that that works because of the sign language too, but they just kind of make it believable with the way they do the camera work on the face shots there. Sort of the cut that like we get the idea that the son could actually see his dad's eyes too, like the way they shoot it, right? I love that because like they really cleverly, I keep saying that word, but the choreography of the camera work when Jean-Claude Van Damme gets out onto the ice and gets on the bench and is kind of just like shielding himself is really well done. It's really subtle, like so that you kind of believe he kind of gets in this game and no one realizes that it's him.
Yeah, it's even better when you get it from him looking down the ice. He's just being like, keep it down there, stay on the other side, don't come, oh shit, it's coming. Like if anyone who's ever played goalie, that is what you do. Like if you're not good at goalie, I mean, I had like flashbacks the first time I had to play goalie like in a league. I was terrible at it. That was all I was doing. I'm like, don't cross the red line, don't cross. I'm like, oh shit, here they come again. Again, it was like such a good delivery on his part though. And like you guys all mentioned, there's these little like things you have to check off that they dropped in, but like the delivery of it is so like, I thought pretty real. Him just being, like you said, mentioned he was like a B-leaguer goalie and he gets out there and he does like the classic, what no goalie does now, stop it with a two pad stack to make the glove save, right? Just like the perfect 90s like save that you can imagine. I loved it. It was like such a great moment, but like it combined, like you said, like the heartwarmingness, the over the top, like slapstick nature of sports movies that we kind of want in there. But it also had like real stakes to the plot in this game that's going on. And the way he gets off the ice is even better because it's so abrupt. And it's almost like cheating as a writer, but if it's a hockey game, right, you can punch someone, right? So you have him just go out there and like hit somebody. It's like, I love the coach too. Whoever's playing the coach is like, I didn't actually look up if that's a actor, hockey player, anything like that. But the coach is the best delivery of when he gets in there and he tells him, oh, you're feeling better? Get your ass out there, right? Just like, that's a good delivery. And then what the fuck you doing? What the fuck? Just great coach delivery on the bench. I thought that was like, it threw back to Slapshot. Right. Yeah. It gives us like that quality of slap shot that we want. And then right back into like the tense action. It was a weird break from this, from the movie, but like you didn't really know you needed it, but you kind of wanted it.
Yeah. Kind of campy, but also heroic. Yeah. It kind of lets Van Damme kind of shine for that one moment in a totally different setting. And the coach, when Van Damme like starts that fight to get out of the game, to get ejected, the coach is like, that's $1,000 fine. Like that's the only thing he's worried about. It's like game seven, it's like $1,000 fine.
I laugh so hard. Little, it's so petty compared to today's fines, right? That's like a parking fine today.
I know. And it's not like he was like concerned for him when the concern should be the fact that he's in like the most important game of his coaching career probably.
Yeah, and they're still down by a goal, and now the goalie has a 5-minute major in the box. I mean, it's hilarious. I also loved the fact that when he does the sign language to his kid, right, just how much of a trope that was in the 90s, right? That scene where the father is trying to win their family back in a way, or just trying to gain the confidence maybe of themselves or maybe of their family. And then it's the moment where the kid believes in them again, right? And It makes me think of like a scene in the Arnold movie, Jingle All the Way, or movies like that. I'm trying to think of other ones where like suddenly the kid realizes that's their parents on this big stage doing this grandiose thing. This happened a lot in 90s movies. Yeah. And I'm a little bummed I can't think of more literal, like one-to-one, it happened in this movie and that movie. But I promise you, there was a ton of these.
I was going to say, Rookie of the Year, we find out on the mound that his mom used to be the pitcher who taught him the pitch that he knew, right?
Yeah, it's that epiphany, right? Where it's like, oh my gosh, that's my dad, right? The big reveal on the big stage. I just thought that was a lot of fun. I also love the announcers. You brought them up because you know them, right? They're long-term Pittsburgh announcers, Matt. Do you know their names and like their style? Because I love just their personality, especially when Jean-Claude Van Damme, right, comes on. And when at first he makes the save on the breakaway where he skates out and he flips over and hits his head, the line where he hits his head so hard his baby's going to be born dizzy just had me rolling. But there's some funny one-liners from those two broadcasters. So I'm just curious if you knew their names and somewhat of their like persona and so forth.
Yeah. So that was Mike Lang and Paul Steigerwald, both of whom, one was the color commentator. Mike Lang was the play-by-play guy. And he just retired like a few years ago. And he was iconic in Pittsburgh, and mostly because he had so many great catchphrases that people just use on the regular. One of them was like, scratch my back with a hacksaw, or call Arnold Slick from Turtle Creek. And Turtle Creek is like an area in Pittsburgh, like way on the boonies. And he would make up these names, or like, buy Sam a drink and get his dog one too.
What do these even mean?
Yeah, they don't mean anything. And like, get in the fast lane, grandma, this game's ready to roll.
Oh, that's great.
So he would, Elvis has just left the building would be a big one whenever they won a game. That was his closing line. But yeah, he was able to, not only did they have like two announcers, but they were Pittsburgh announcers in this movie. So it felt credible. Yeah, it added to that kind of energy. I think at one point, another great like special effects scene or kind of, you know, real effects was when one of the villains drops on top of the Jumbotron and sparks fly from off it. And I was like, this is awesome. This is awesome. So cool. And the other commentator, Paul Steigerwald, Staggy, he's like, oh shit. He's like jumps up when that scene happens. I was like, this is great. This is phenomenal. And but yeah, Mike Lang is like an icon. And in terms of, you know, play-by-play guys across the country, I can't think of many who had this many great catchphrases that were, you could basically like trademark them and you'll know who said it. Like kids growing up would just throw them at each other as catchphrases. And the other guy, Staggy, was also great. He was a very Homer kind of color commentator guy who became the play-by-play guy as he got older. But the fact that they're there, and I think early on in the film, we kind of see like the TV room, like the control room, like one of the security guards who's pretending to be a insider CIA guy. He's like, how many cameras are there here? Like 15 cameras. He's like, you're not supposed to be here. And I mean the whole setup with the TV and then the ESPN music, all that stuff.
Love that. Yeah. I just wanted to bring that up too, man. Every time they brought on that NHL song, the Dated and Glorious song. Oh, I just, that was the best part. And the arena chants, right? I mean, they still do those a little bit, but not that specific one. There's one in the movie where I was like, oh, let's bring that chant back. Like in every game. Da, da,
da, da. Hey, every team used to have that in the 90s. Every team. Right?
Yeah.
Now every team has their own little soundtrack that they do. But yeah.
I think that one was specific also. Like every arena, right, has their own song that they like overplay. It's that their song, you know, like.
Yeah. Right, like they used to be Queen for the Kings. They used to be like, we will rock you. And like Kelly Rudy would dance in his crease.
Kelly Rudy was good. Yeah. And like Chicago has their own. I think Penguins, that was one of theirs. Like that's one of their big ones. So yeah, everything felt accurate. And I think Luc Robitaille, he got the role because he was friends with the writer, Karen Baldwin, who created the story and was the owner's wife and also producing partner. And she's like, I was in acting class with Luc Robitaille, so he had an in with me. And I was like, you're getting the part.
Oh, that's fun. I mean, I also love the locker room scene too. I don't know the player, but the naked player was, they're having fun with that. They're having a lot of good time with that guy. Yeah. You know, the vice president.
When he's going to meet the vice president.
Yeah, right.
And maybe the best 1-2 joke punch in the movie is when the vice president walks in and asks them if they're Democrats or Republicans and they respond, we're Canadians.
Oh, yeah.
It really
is. They ask, are you going to say the same thing to the Blackhawks?
Yeah. It was really great banter. I also want to stick up for two things, too, because I do think that, like, as dumb as it is that they wait for this whole game, you know, to end, to set off the bombs, right? They do at least, like, in the script, right, in the screenplay, give apologies or defenses for that, right? Because he does say, like, they're trying to get one third of the money each intermission. Mm-hmm. And I love when it goes into sudden death, the bad guy is just like, well, life's a little shitbox of ironies, I guess. He's got this dark humor that, like, he's just having so much fun as a baddie, and he knows it, that the fact that it's delayed, it's fun. It's a good time. And you know how they're killing people every single intermission because they don't have enough money? His interaction with the computer guy, the bald-headed henchman.
The dude's just playing, like, Doom while he's waiting. There's a hockey game. He's just playing some Doom on his computer.
It's so funny when he's, like, asking him how much money, and then, like, the guy's basically teasing everyone in the room, being like, oh, it's kind of good, but not great enough or whatever, right?
Picking he's like people. The perfect, like, 90s hacker dude. You don't know what the fuck a hacker does in the 90s, but he's doing it. He's doing it good.
Yeah, there was that role. It was like the Seth Green in Enemy of the State. You had to have one of those guys in the movie. Alan Cumming in the GoldenEye. The same kind of role.
Exactly, yes. And you remind me so much of the people in Hackers, in the movie Hackers.
Yeah, one of the other cool aspects of Sudden Death that made it unique is that it was part of these movies where the villain was a disgruntled civil servant or the kind of domestic terrorist. And much the same vein as, like, Malkovich in The Line of Fire or Ed Harris in The Rock. For once, like, the villains weren't foreigners. You know, like, Alan Rickman's, like, British, trying to pretend he's American. They weren't Russian. They weren't vaguely Middle Eastern, like they were in Executive Decision, which is another good kind of Die Hard on a Plane movies, which they made a slew of in the 90s. And it was kind of this just sardonic, acerbic guy who used to work apparently in the Secret Service. We talked about his very, like, opaque job description or why he's mad, really. We're not sure. He just holds out a vendetta against the government. But the fact that it was, like, someone domestically based kind of made it stand out. That was such a neat aspect. I like that they used that in the film. It didn't use the cliches that were around action movies around that time in America.
Awesome. Yeah, that's so awesome. But no, I think that they stuck up for that pretty well. The bombs, I don't know how he knew where the bombs were either, but I do like this, that one bomb still went off, right? The one next to the water, which created a cool cinematic sequence. It was believable. It wasn't too tragic, but it also was good that he didn't defuse every single bomb.
And it worked with the panic, because I thought that was a good depiction of, like, the panic of exiting the arena and all that. It just needed, like, that one little spark of chaos. So, yeah, it worked really well. And again, it was one of those cool shots you'd already seen before, like with that arena, like that section of the arena. So it was a good, like, drawback.
Yeah. The mass exodus of people, like, storming out, trampling, falling over each other, crushing each other, the water. He did, like, a similar scene, Peter Himes, in The Relic, the movie about the monster in a museum. And there was a great mass exodus scene in that too. And I was like, this guy gets it. I don't know how he's shooting it so well, but yeah, I love the bombs that were going off in the parking lot too. Like the random cars that were just exploding in the air. And then that henchman who kills the chef's wife, he's got, like, a bazooka. He just fires it and destroys one of the helicopters at one point, right? And those villains too, like, they look like an 80s grunge band, like Motley Crue or Iron Maiden. And they had, like, the long earrings, the crazy hair. It was like this whole, like, vibe. It was very cool. It was very particular, I think, to that time too.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, totally. Like, that was, like, when that stuff was kind of, like, going out, and, like, that was still, like, grunge was still a little, like, at its height, right? Huh. So I thought that same thing too. It's like these dudes look like roadies, man.
yeah, like Andre Agassi kind of just don't give a crap. Yeah,
totally. The Andre Agassi guy was definitely the kidnapper of the old lady, I would say, right?
Right.
He had the cool earring. No, definitely. I love the parking lot shots too. Just the nighttime scenes with the cop lights. They looked so crisp. They looked so good. It ends with, you know, our hero coming out on a stretcher like Con Air, like so many of these movies.
Yeah, like Die Hard and some of these other ones.
Yeah. And just all those movies with the hostage situation going on. What's the one about the radio station that played on Comedy Central for, like, years on?
Oh, dude, Airheads.
Airheads. Yeah, thank you.
Great one.
Yeah. Didn't that have a ton of, like, exterior shots outside of it with all the cops and the speakerphone? That was such a common motif of all these films, and it had a few of those. I loved it, all of the, you know, insiders, right? The twist we get where a good guy is suddenly the bad guy, right? The head of the police is actually the bad guy too.
He had one of the better one-liners, because there's, like, a perfect, like, 90s one, and it encompasses, like, angry cop, like, his reasoning probably for being part of it, he's like, "Well, tell my ex-wife her gravy train went off the tracks." I was like, it's such a bad line. His delivery was so good that I was like, this dude hates his ex-wife. You gotta have that in these 90s, 80s movies with these disgruntled cops. They're always divorced.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Always divorced. And you know, they have all the funny clues where he finds out right before someone's about to kill him that they're actually a bad guy. You know, the name on the Pittsburgh Penguins hat. You know, Matt, you're rocking one right now on the pod. Our listeners can't see us, but you're rocking one of those hats. You should get a Sharpie and write, I forget what the name of it is, but you should write that on it just as an inside joke. So you hang out with that on your cap. Yeah. The person in the dishwasher room, but this was actually the scene where he gets killed, I think, on the fryer. You know, the curly haired guy, that cool guy.
Yeah.
Saying the mascot impersonator's name on accident, right? Just all the ways he figures out, you know, that these people are actually on the inside of this crazy scheme. They're fun. They're a ton of fun. The mm-hmm. fact that they're like so quick to look up who this firefighter is, right? On the evil end to build that side, right? So that there's like kind of a competition, you know, the competitive nature mm-hmm. between the bad guy and, you know, this obscure blue collar servant figure.
Right.
Really well done. And the last thing I thought in the film, in the narrative sense, that was nicely played was the kid sitting in his seat the whole time when the whole arena is empty and that one kid just like, "But dad, I stayed in my seat," right? I mean, and he still laughs
at the scenes where he's sitting there and everyone's just running out. Even as I all remember in theaters, I think we're probably the only ones laughing at that scene. A bunch of adults are probably a little more serious there. But I always remember, like, even as kids, like, I'd get the fuck out of there. I ain't sitting there with all this shit going on. But that delivery, like you said, like, the heartwarmingness, I laugh and then I feel good. I mean, you can't top that.
Yeah. And, you know, he stands by the whole premise that you never leave with a stranger, too.
It's so funny because his dad's so nice. And he gives him like one command, kind of mean, and it just like scars his kid for the whole movie. He's just like, he saw Medusa. He's not going anywhere. That's one thing I kind of thought about this second time around seeing it.
Totally. But no, well played. And the last sequence with the helicopter, the rooftop fight, zip lining down, you know, busting the plexiglass. I mean, all of that is just so awesome. We have tapped into that. So, I mean, we've definitely, hopefully paid this the praise and coverage it definitely deserves. And I think we're at a good point to all give it an underdog overrated vote. It's going to be maybe our most telegraphed one yet. So that said, I think you could just call it what it is and then give your last 2 cents about this. Anything that maybe you didn't get to bring up yet that's kind of lurking in the background of your mind or just any last words about this film. And I'll start with you, Matt. How about you? Underdog overrated and yeah.
Underdog big time. I think we took this film for granted just because maybe there was such a glut of diehard ripoffs at the time. This movie maybe got lost in the shuffle, and I think it did modestly well. I don't think it was even profitable in the box office, but it did well and had a second life on TV and cable and DVD sales. People kind of found it through being a TNT or TBS rewatchable, and it was always on TV growing up. And nowadays there aren't many films like this. There aren't many action films made that are this good and are made of this craft of talent. And, you know, now maybe like Gerard Butler, like Plane was in a movie like that, or Ambulance with Michael Bay, or when Liam Neeson decides to work with Colette Sarah with, like, you know, The Commuter, Unknown, also kind of diehard influenced movies. Those are great. But the fact that we can name like all three of them right now in the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, it's kind of an indictment of how times have changed in Hollywood and how it is sort of polarized. It's either super big budget Marvel movies or these like really indie A24 movies and less in between, less in the middle. Films like this or Passenger 57. And though we took it for granted, man, this movie looks really good and has aged really well. It looks like a movie. It looks like film. You can kind of feel the graininess of it or the light shining through the windows or the air. And then when it gets nighttime, the stadium becomes its own character and it's a monster. And Jean-Claude, by doing kind of less in a way, he's kind of a little bit more subtle and it takes time. He does a lot more for me here. And I feel like a lot of his other films feel a lot more campy and kind of lame. Whereas this didn't. This felt like he was in on like a real movie. Like this is like a legitimate expedition. And it helped out Powers Booth, who the villain kind of has to steal a lot of the scenes here. And he was every bit as good as, like, you know, he's up there with Alan Rickman or Dennis Hopper in Speed. If you got Powers Booth, you were happy with your movie. And Sudden Death merged the kind of hockey sports genre with a terrorist plot. It sounds ridiculous on paper, but they executed it so well that you kind of just tip your cap. And it's always fun to rewatch.
Yeah, definitely. And it is interesting that it wasn't a huge failure, though. That's good. I guess the Die Hard movies were kind of the thing in the 90s, right? So by the end of its box office run, it almost doubled its money. It was on a $35 million budget. First of all, look how much they got out of that $35 million. Isn't that unreal? Like we've said so many times, it's a gorgeous film. Kind of in the same way, though, that Ambulance wasn't that much money and looks amazing, right? Mm-hmm. These movies are very affordable to make and often make a ton back. So I do see a renaissance of this type of film coming very soon. Too many of them, in my opinion, are put on streamers. Like, you know, all of these Liam Neeson films, right? There's like so many on Prime and so forth. And they're not all bad. The problem with them, though, is they all look like they're made for streaming. Like they don't have the cinematography. They don't have that beautiful film stock. And so they just feel disposable because of that. Almost more than anything else. A lot of them have cool stories too. We kind of have a lot of these even today, I think, but these got the prestige production value in the 90s. And that's why they stood the test of time. And that's why all these other ones are getting just lost in the, you know, the algorithms of these streamers. But yeah, I don't know if I said the exact amount, but this made $64 million on that $35 million budget. So it did okay, but man, it definitely just gained traction with time as well. Like this is one that, you know, not enough though, but a lot of people who love action movies tout and stick behind. It has a cult following, I should say. But I'm curious, I don't really know how strong it is. That's why I'll quickly give mine to right now that I call it an underdog as well, because I actually do think this one's lost in the Die Hard clone movies, right? People will bring up Speed before this one. People will bring up Die Hard, of course, before this one. People will bring up Cliffhanger a lot before this one. And I'm not trying to say those are bad movies. I'm just trying to say that this one is just as good as any of those, in my opinion. I know that it's a little sacrilege to say this is just as good as Die Hard, but man, I have just as much fun when I watch this. If not a little more fun. I would recognize that Die Hard is the OG and maybe the better movie, but just personally, subjectively, I don't know. This is kind of like my Die Hard favorite of that subgenre. So I'll stick by this as a complete underdog movie. It's just also so of the NHL in the 90s. You know, we mentioned that the Penguins won 91 and 92. Before we started, I was trying to find my Penguins jersey. And we were trying to just like figure out why I even had all this Penguins gear as a preteen living in LA. And the only thing that we could think of is that it's just they were a cultural phenomenon at the time. Probably this movie a bit. But I mean, all their players, Jaromir Jagr, Mario Lemieux, they were just household names. And there's a lot of stars in the NHL all the time. Mm-hmm. But we were rocking Penguin stuff. So anyways, that's why I stick by this as a huge underdog for me. Nice. How about you, Jordan?
Yeah, this one's going to be an underdog for me, but also, I'm going to say as an underdog as a hockey movie this time. This is like, we list like Slapshot, Mighty Ducks, Mystery Alaska, and these other ones. This one is a real like pretty much homage incorporating like real players. We only really get like Luke is the only one, and Caulfield's the only one to have like lines, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's still like players playing as Jagr, as Eddie Belfour. Remember, like the dude who got to play Eddie Belfour, I was looking up, this is like stoked that he got to use Belfour's secondary gear, so he got to wear his actual helmet, right? It's like this movie, like watch this, makes me want to play like bust out Sega and play like NHL 94 and 95, right? It's on that level. And I was like watching, and like the shots of hockey are so good, as you said, because they're using just real dudes. But what they took, man, they had so many good moves that look way better in this than like a lot of 90s games. Like this looked closer to some of these plays they're pulling off to like what you'd see it like, you know, towards 2001 and all that. Like, cause you know, they're just, like you said, it's an exhibition game. So they're just like slipping it around. But that move that Luke pulls off for like the breakaway goal, right? So slick, right? Such a sick ass of the time hockey move. Like I said, the save already. I feel like that's not talked about enough, what they pulled off here. And like you said, it's background stuff or the plot, but like there's so many good hockey shots in there that just don't get mentioned enough. And I was like, as I watch, I'm like, damn, like a real game going on there. And I was really digging that this time. So for me, it's underrated, obviously, as an action movie, that, but I think it's underrated as like in the hockey canon of movies. I don't think it's counted as a hockey movie because it's a Van Damme movie. Like I said, it's a Die Hard movie. It kind of falls in those umbrellas, but I'm gonna give it more of a push as like a good like hockey movie, not just like a 90s action movie. This is a good hockey movie for hockey fans.
I do think it's funny too, because it really is a hockey movie, right? It has the NHL rights all over this. And I think you brought this up in your article, Matt, but one of the funny ironies of this is that, as we mentioned earlier, it was a story by Karen Baldwin, right? The then wife of the owner of the team. Mm-hmm. And there's something really deeply hilarious that she wrote a film set in the building that maybe they don't own the building, but you know, that their franchise hosts their events at. that's taken over by terrorists and turned into a ticking time bomb. Like, it's just really, there's something hilarious about that fact, like creating this space that you want to pitch to a potential fans in the future as a dangerous, precarious terrorist bomb haven.
It's a weird pitch, right? Because like, that's the most dangerous spot is the best seats in the house in this one. Like, you actually want to be below the box in this, which I found crazy. I'm with you. I was like, how do they justify it, right? As a promo for the franchise.
Yeah, hilarious to me. The other funny thing about this to me too is that we never learn who wins.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that 10 minutes ago, actually. Yeah,
that's great. Like, so it's all about that tie. They definitely show some of the overtime, like they have some close calls.
Yeah,
but we never learn who wins, right? It's the Stanley Cup that never was. I want to have a sequel, a legacy sequel, please. Let's do a legacy sequel year where they do like the rematch because they have to replay the game.
Yeah, they play the game.
Yeah.
The movie's so quick that, you know, we talk about the beginning, the little kid who looks like a doll just dies. We don't even see like the lead up into that firehouse. Just like a couple scenes, then someone's dead, boom, over. Same with the ending. The movie ends, yeah. He saves the day, he gets those kids, and then it cuts to black. We're done. We're out of here. Who cares about the game?
I love that. Yeah, they put him on that stretcher outside of the arena, and it was already written for them, right? Yeah, they're just like, fill in the blank. This is the end of Con Air, right? They didn't need the stuffed animal. They didn't need to bring in all these tropes and stuff. They're like, you get it. Boom. Credits. We're done. Mm-hmm. We're out. But yeah, that's, I think, a feature, not a bug of this film, right? It's pacing. Okay. But anyways, great film. We need the legacy. We want the legacy sequel.
We can even switch the sport. We can do it in a football arena or something, right?
All right. You think that move it, keep it Pittsburgh? They could move it to the Steelers.
Good city for this one.
Move it to the Steelers. But then my whole thing, right? My whole thesis is that the game wasn't finished. So they could just do a shootout and they're all 55 years old because they decided. But like, they lace up their skates one last time and they're just good enough to like be able to manage and muster a shootout. There's just enough, you know, surviving.
It's like the worst alumni weekend ever.
Because we learned that like it was too much of a tragic incident, you know, like the Bills game this year, that they just couldn't go on with it after. So like, it had an asterisk for that year forever. They were co-champs, but like they decided they needed a real champ. I don't know. Sorry. Anyways.
One final thing I want to say, the origin idea for the movie apparently was that Karen Baldwin and her husband Howard, who owned the team, they wanted to do a movie called Red Line, which is about a Soviet goalie who was defecting because he was like wearing this mask. And they didn't do that movie, but they like turned it, you know, the goalie played a big role because Van Damme played it in the movie. So that's kind of cool. And the other part is I've never thought about, there are no sports hostage movies. Like there were so many hostage films, Paul, you alluded to it in the 90s, whether The Negotiator, or like John Q. Most of them I think were bad, or like Mad City with John Travolta, which is a terrible movie. But there was never like a hostage situation in an arena. There was always like maybe a bomb that would go off, like in Sum of All Fears, or when Robert De Niro's like the catcher in The Fan, the Tony Scott movie about the baseball player. But there was never like this situation. So that's kind of cool that this movie, you know, not only did it well, but it's like the only film that was able to tackle this setting.
No, it's such a great point, right? Because it is one of those places you get anxiety as a human. Any place with a big crowd, you can get anxiety, right? And so it's so prime for that, right? There is, though, I want to bring this up. It's funny. It's a Judd Apatow film, came out in 1996, and it's not in an arena, but there is a sports hostage film. I wonder, now that we brought this up, how ostensibly inspired it was by this. And that is Celtic Pride, because isn't that about two Boston Celtics fanatics kidnapping the star player of the other team, right? So it's very different. So your point is actually correct, but like, I just thought that was really funny, is that they have like, in a loose way, another film about a kidnapping, right? But this is more of like this governmental hostage, big bomb thing going on. And that is this attempt to sabotage the opposing team, which is just brilliant. But no, I just thought that one, but yeah. This is one of the, I think this is the only true sports movie, action movie in my mind. And there's a lot of them, but like one of the ones that really balances them. Awesome. Well, this was so much fun. Matt, tell our listeners where they can find you and where they can interact with you online.
Yeah, for sure. At YagerWatch68 is my Twitter handle. I'll probably tweet a lot about movies and random articles that I write. I have a few coming up in the next few months, one on Reservoir Dogs and went on Decision to Leave. So that should come out. Great movie that came out last year, Decision to Leave. But yeah, I'm on Twitter either complaining about the Penguins general managers or talking about movies like we do so much. Yeah. If you want to talk about Sudden Death or anything else, I'm on there. Hit me up.
Yeah, absolutely. Decision to Leave is amazing. I can't wait to read that. And I love both your film takes and your hockey takes. Not enough hockey people in our country still, right? But we're like, it's the of the big five. It's definitely like the marginal sport still, at least in social media senses. So yeah, always appreciate that presence as well. So check him out. And Jordan, where can people interact with us?
Yeah, you can interact with us and find us on Twitter at Cinematic Underdogs. Of course, listen to us on Spotify and Apple Music. Just search Cinematic Underdogs. And while you're there, go ahead and like it, leave a review, let us know your favorite Jean-Claude Van Damme, either move, death, or his one-liner. That's what we want to know. Anything else, Paul?
No, that's about it. I just want someone to like vocalize a cappella style the NHL song from that 90s, because I don't know what you need. It's a big task, but to send us out, man, I'm terrible at it, but
isn't it dun 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 dun? No, that's
NFL.
Oh god, yeah, now I can't do it.
There's just like a splash of
too much on the spot.
It's kind of like that. It's like
I'll just get it. I will find it.
Yeah, just throw it on there.
I'll throw it on there for the first time, but I'm gonna leave this in here because I love the outtakes.
For sure.
The naturalism. All right. Thanks for listening, y'all. We'll see you next time.